Hi, it's Yumi Steins from the Ladies We Need to Talk podcast. If you've never heard it before, let me explain it to you. Ladies We Need to Talk is a must listen that goes deep on the stuff that really matters to women. If it's a topic going off in your group chat, we're across it with love, science and real life women telling their stories, from perimenopause to the mental load, fertility to friendship. Find Ladies We Need to Talk in the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Today's conversation includes content that may be upsetting for some listeners. If you or someone you know needs help, Lifeline is always there for you on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14.
Kate Rowe's life has been full of adventure and hard living. Ever since she stepped off the boat at Circular Quay, as a 20-something, 10-pound pom. Kate travelled around Australia, picking tobacco, hitchhiking, and spent her weekends running riot in King's Cross. Then in 1974, she tagged along with some random guys she met who wanted to walk across the island of Timor. And so they did, just as all the turmoil there was about to break out. From there, Kate ventured into Southeast Asia, coming up with a lunatic idea to smuggle bricks of cannabis out of Thailand into Nepal. But everywhere she went, she brought herself along with her. All kinds of baggage from her early life came along for the wild ride. But eventually, a cloud lifted, and Kate realised something absolutely huge and significant about herself. Now, just to let you know, there are some distressing episodes in Kate's story, and some unavoidable strong language. So to put it on the airwaves, I might have to drop the levels here and now, starting right here, because Kate's memoir is called How the Fuck Would I Know? Hello, Kate.
Hi there. Good to meet you, Richard.
Where was home for you in most of your childhood?
It was in a place called Putney on a dreadful council estate. We lived there for 10 years, from when I was 7 to 17, and it's always been my thing that I say it was a nightmare.
Where did your family fit into the wonderful British class system as it was back then?
Yeah, really, that was why it was a bit of a nightmare, because my father had trained to be a priest. He grew up and was schooled in Belgium in a monastery, but then obviously didn't. And my mother was born in India, or part of the British Raj, so when they got kicked out of India, they came back to England, and that's how my mother and father met. So pretty middle class, really, you would say. But they had no money and they were Catholic, so they had kids and I was the second. And I remember we actually were homeless for, I was about three, but I still remember my mother screaming as we were separated from my father, because the men went into a hostel and the women and the kids went into another one. And so that's how we ended up in housing, because, you know, we had no housing. It was Putney, so I went to a primary school on the estate. They had a high school on the estate, but there were a lot of pregnancies. So somehow my mother got me and my sister Helen to a girls' school in nearby Fulham. So, yeah, but I still like the place.
How big was the family?
Four. So there was Helen, who's sadly deceased now, myself and Peter and Simon, my two brothers.
Were you kids close, the four of you?
When we were very young, we were very close, because we used to get beaten up a lot and I used to defend my brothers. So because my mother also worked, we were left on our own a lot, a lot.
When you're in that kind of environment, bright kids like to find a little escape place they can go to. Was there a place like that for you, anywhere in Putney you could go and sort of be on your own and be in your own mind?
Oh, totally. It was Putney Heath, literally across the road, like 5 minutes from where our flat was. And I used to go there as a child to escape the family and what was going on in there, but also because it was peaceful and I would just walk for hours and be on my own for hours and had a huge imagination, loved talking to the birds. And I'm not that much different in the terms of wanting to be in nature. That's my go-to place.
You write that you started off with very good grades at school, but then they dropped.
Yeah.
Can you tell me that story about what was going on at the
yeah,
time?
Yeah, that was, and you can't change the past, but like, so I was very good at English. I was very good at biology, geography. I was curious. I was a curious kid. I loved to learn everything. And then my sister came home one day and said she was going to be babysitting for this gardener. We had a private, very posh private housing estate next to the council estate. And she'd met this guy who was the gardener there, and he needed someone to look after his 18-month-old child while he worked on Saturday mornings, and you got 10 shillings for it. And so she did that, and she came home one and just said, "I'm not doing that. Do you want to do it? I don't want to do this anymore." No explanation, which I've rethink about now. So I did it. I was able to buy my first transistor radio. And so I did that. And it, you know, that was 5 years I did that. The young girl was only 18 months old, and I basically was her sister or her mother for 5 years. I taught her to read. But the abuse happened probably within about 3 or 4 months.
From the gardener?
From the gardener. And that's when everything changed.
How old were you when that started?
I was 11 when it started. It only finished because we moved up to Manchester.
Was there any way you could understand what was going on? I mean, there's much greater awareness about these things now, but was there at the time in your mind, did you understand that this man was perpetrating something monstrous?
No, I mean, not at all. You know, they say you've got to keep this a secret, and I love you, Katie. That's my name. Uh-huh. I love you, Katie. And, you know, it became a bit of a ritual. I'd go around there, I'd cook dinner, we'd put the young girl to bed, and as soon as that happened, it started.
Was he actually like play-acting like you were husband and wife or
yes,
something?
Yes, absolutely that's what was going on. In fact, when I was about 15 or 16, he said, "When I'm 16, I want to marry you." And I just thought this was fabulous because it meant I didn't have to deal with what was going on at home. Clearly, for me, I could see that I was depressed. My life, my childhood was changing rapidly. But the hormones start. I mean, I had my first orgasm with him. He explained what was going on, and this is what adults do. And in no way did I think it was abnormal.
You're making dinner and putting them. So what hour were you coming home at night?
Well, I always said to my parents, who were negligent to some degree, because they'd met him. He'd come round for dinner. I'd gone away to Birmingham to see his parents.
Well, like, this nice man.
Yeah, they trusted him. And I'd say, I'm going to be home at 9 o'clock. And I always made sure I was home at 9 o'clock. If they twigged, they never said anything.
What's been some of the lingering after effects of that grooming and that abuse?
Well, I can work it out now because they do say, you know, childhood sexual abuse can take 30, 40 years to come to the surface, sometimes never. I'm just very ordinary in that regard. Just that's exactly what happened. I'm 75, nearly 75 now. That's still, I learn how to trust, but I'm always a bit tentative about that trust. And in terms of intimacy, that's always been really difficult and probably still is. I don't know. I don't go there. I'm not kind of sexually intimate anymore. But, you know, I have to really trust people to be open with them. And I've got one or two especially good friends that I feel I can just be totally myself and not be guarded. So there's always that sense of, well, if I let you in, are you going to hurt me? And I don't think that ever goes away. I've just learnt to live with it.
So in Manchester, cut off from this relationship with this man, what effect did that have on you then as this kind of teenager now in Manchester, no longer in the presence of this man?
It was hard because I didn't even want to go to Manchester. It was like I'm 17, I've got to start again, I've got to find a job. I didn't know anyone. So I got a job as a waitress, and that's when I met my first boyfriend who was a registered drug addict. And really, the story became the same. I just was changing the name, if you see. I was just starting to repeat a pattern of being in a relationship that was abusive with absolutely no awareness that that's what was going on.
How did you make your way to Australia at that point?
Yeah. I understand now it was very much a propaganda tool because I didn't know about the White Australia policy. I'd never lived here. I'd actually.
This is 71 or there?
Yeah, early 70, 70.
So the White Australia policy is only starting to be dismantled, but it's still pretty much in place.
Oh, yeah. And the immigration scheme was post-war. So you could choose to go to Canada, I think even South Africa, Commonwealth countries, Australia, and I think maybe even New Zealand. And I love geography, and I just was enamoured with Australia when I learnt about it at school, and I'd read all Neville Shute's books, especially the one about Alice Springs, and I just fantasised that I'd be a Jillaroo. And so there I was. I was depressed. I'd been thrown out of home for possessing drugs. I was in trouble with the police. I remember I was in this awful cold bedsit. only a British person would know how awful those bedsteads are.
Oh, yeah.
Freezing.
I lived in one for a while.
Yeah.
Oh, they're awful.
With a radiator heater.
And you put coins in the
heater. And that's so you only had a bath twice a week. And I just remember I was walking up to Piccadilly Station and the concourse, they had Immigration House and had these fabulous photos of Australia and Sydney and Adelaide and everywhere, beaches and the sun. And I thought, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. And I applied. And what I didn't realise is they really needed single white young women to propagate white young other kids. But lots of people, usually working class people, it was a way out for them.
Turns out they weren't getting quite the migrant they had in mind.
No.
And we're all the better for that, of course. Yeah. So what do you remember of the ship pulling into Sydney Harbour? Oh,
look, I can still remember it was September, so it was spring. I remember I had a purple jumper on, as skinny as anything, and I just remember coming around the heads. I mean, the Opera House was barely being built, I think, and you've got the Harbour Bridge on your right and you turn down to Circular Quay and it was just stunning. I mean, I just thought, oh, my God, this is where I'm meant to be.
There are lots of parts of Sydney that are not quite as lovely as
Sydney
Harbour. Yeah. Where was your first job?
Well, those days I earned so much money, like I got $42 a week. And to me, that was like probably $35 more than I'd ever earned in my life. I didn't know. I thought I had become rich. And I worked my arse off. And I was in a factory checking the hairspray cans. You turn it up and over and then put them back on the conveyor belt. And that's what you did
that
all
was it.
Day. That was it. And I got RSI within 2 days and they sacked me. So that's what it was like back then. You could walk into anything because there was so much work.
How was your behaviour around drugs and alcohol going at those in those days?
Well, I managed to stay pretty clean. I was drinking, but I confined it to the weekends. And then I decided to go back to school because I'd left school without anything. So at Tech, I did the school certificate and a certificate of advanced education. I was really studious. I don't know how, this is how I thought I had my life in control. I'd study and do all my essays in the week. And then come Friday night, I was on that train from Harris Park. And I spent the weekends up the cross and I got absolutely wasted and found a French boyfriend and we'd drop acid. I ended up in Vinnie's hospital so many times. It was just two separate worlds. And then Sunday night, I'd recover by Monday morning and I'd go back to work. I was working in a printing factory and carry on studying.
I remember seeing a lot of people doing that in the 80s, for example, and I'm sure that still goes on now. You have this straighty 180 life from Monday to Friday and then come Friday night, all hell breaks loose and then you try and pull yourself back together again for Monday morning.
And which I think you can do when you're young. Like I'm only 22 at this age, so I can do that.
So you did a bit of travelling around Australia. What kind of things were you doing as you were travelling around Australia?
Yeah, that was really interesting. I thought, oh, I'm going to spend the money I'd saved to travel around Australia. So I went tobacco farming around Myrtleford near Bright and you stayed on the farm. And they didn't pay you till you left the season, but they gave you a bit of pocket money to go and get some extra goodies for food. But I think when I look back now, I think one thing I've got is I guess I'm a resilient person that I can pivot and deal with whatever's in front of me most of the time. And so that was very isolating. Didn't have any drugs, but we did drink a lot.
So there are all these moments in your memoir where I think, What? You're doing what? And this brings me to one of those episodes, which is while you were travelling around Australia, there was suddenly the idea to go to Timor.
Yeah.
Whose idea was this? Was this your idea?
Well, I'd gone up to Cairns, which was like a tiny village then, and I'd met these blokes and I was the only woman. And I basically, if you're doing that, I'll do that. Like I never really had a plan of my own. So they said, we're going to go to Bali, but we have to get over to Darwin. So we spent like a week getting over there.
What, in a car, a combi or a hitching?
We were hitching.
Right.
And that was, I remember in Commonwealth, they were so drunk. They were driving. The boot came up. They were drunk as skunks. How we didn't crash that car, I don't know. Slept on, got kicked off verandas for sleeping on. Anyway, it was a bit of an adventure. But when you're young, I think you just take it in, that's how it is. Then we got to Darwin and they said, look, we want to walk over Timor. I knew nothing about Timor. I don't think too many people did know anything about Timor then. And I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea.
Walking across Timor?
We walked across Timor.
How did you get to Timor?
So we got on a plane to Dili and we stayed at a hostel in Dili But the revolution in Portugal had happened.
The military dictatorship in Portugal was overthrown.
That's
and it was making its transition to democracy.
Yes, right.
Which meant Portugal was pulling out of East Timor, which then set all those events in train.
Yes.
So you arrived in Timor just
when the revolution, they were celebrating and they were absolutely fantastic. I thought the revolution had been won. I was very naive. But they just brought out a lot of red wine and we got really wasted. They took me to a cockfight, which was abhorrent. And so then we started and it took about 8 days to walk. And without the Portuguese army, we would not have been able to walk across it. And they really looked after us. There were Chinese restaurants, believe it or not, in the middle of nowhere. And they let us sleep on their floors. So
I have to ask, Kate, this is one of the most poor nations in the world. It's very Catholic.
Yes.
It's about to go through an extraordinary political turmoil. What on earth did they make out of a bunch of drug-addled hippies walking from village to village?
I have no idea. I just remember the interesting cultural dress and everybody ate betel nut. So they had like red lips and not many teeth. And they just took it in their stride. I mean, I couldn't speak Portuguese. Certainly couldn't speak the dialect. It was more hand signals. The Portuguese spoke some English, so that was really good. But whatever they thought of us, they treated us with the utmost kindness. And that's literally how we got over to the other side of the island. I just remember there was this ravine and I was really scared. It was wild. And the truck couldn't get across, so we had to walk across this raging, well, it was almost like a river. Very, very deep, but with a massive, strong current. I was crying. I was on the side. I'm not going on that. I'm scared. And it was at night. And without them, if we hadn't been together, I don't think we would have managed the trip.
What's going on here? Is this an appetite for adventure or just not caring too much? What do you think was going on in your mind?
Looking back, I think absolutely it was a mixture of both. Like I've never... I mean, even migrating to Australia, people thought I was mad or brave. And I didn't think anything.
Worked out well and you thought, yeah. Someone says, oh, let's walk across
yeah,
Timor.
Well, let's do, yeah, well, that, let's just do it. There was not much going on in the head. I just thought, oh, well, that's something I can do. No sense of danger. And that was the whole thing about my travels through Southeast Asia. No sense of danger. I just walked into danger almost everywhere I went, but somehow survived.
So then from there you hopped over to Bali, and this is when your straighty 180 period, such as it was, came to an end. How did that come to an end, Kate?
So the first night we were in Bali, and you've got to remember Bali 50 years ago was only Indonesian food, one or two big hotels, but mainly Losmans, all run by families, and a few surfers and mud streets, no hot water. And out came the dope. I'm in Bali, and I thought... Well, I always said to myself, if it finds me, it's okay. If I have to find it, I shouldn't do it. But if it finds me, it's all right. That was my justification for picking up drugs again. That was the beginning of the thin red line, what I call the thin red line.
Where did it escalate to from there?
Oh, well, total addiction. By the time I got to Malaya, I was experimenting with opium. And Thailand, I was heroin. And that's where I got the crazy idea to smuggle Thai Buddha sticks. I went to this town. They said, oh, yeah, these women, they'll sell you the sticks. And they took me to these women. They turned me on with heroin and I had money with me. They gave me the bricks.
So these are bricks of like really high-powered cannabis?
Oh, Thai Buddha, yeah, the best.
And these are literally like bricks?
They're literally sticks and they make 30 or 40 into a brick, like it's a big square oblong. And I had two lots of those.
And what was your plan to – what were you going to do with these bricks?
Well, I was going to smuggle them into every country I went into, which I did.
Man. There's a death penalty for that stuff.
Well, that's right.
Did
back
you know
then,
that?
No. I was aware that you shouldn't have long hair because you could get thrown into jail for long hair. So I'm on this bus coming back. I'm totally off my face on heroin and I'm on this bus. I'm the only white person on this bus. And we get stopped going back to Bangkok and all these police with guns get on and I thought – with a smile on my face because I'm off my tree, oh, I'm done. They're gonna open my backpack with two wrapped up in newspaper, two bricks of Thai Buddha sticks right at the top. No, I didn't try to hide it. And they got on the bus, pulled all these people off. I'm sitting there, and some people get back, and someone told me they were looking for guns because the Vietnam War was on. So there was a whole lot of gun smuggling going on. They never touched me. I mean, how does that happen?
This harebrained idea to smuggle bricks of high-powered cannabis into Nepal. Why Nepal?
Because that was going to be my next port of call. I forgot that they've got their own drugs there. Because I needed some more money because the whole plan was to end up going through Afghanistan. I wanted more money and I was going to try and buy some drugs to smuggle into England. That was my whole trip. So I got a talcum powder can and I got rid of all the talcum powder and I put some talcum powder in and then put the sticks in plastic stuff, packed them back in and then put in the talcum powder. And for whatever reason, it worked. I mean, I didn't get stopped at any of the borders. But when I got to Kathmandu and I took it out, it absolutely reeked of talcum powder. So I could barely sell any of it because, and also because people, what do I want to buy that crap for? It stinks. When, you know, I can go down there and get just down the road, down Pig Alley. Right. It's called Pig Alley, where, you know, that's where they were. So I mean, it was harebrained, but that could have got me into a Thai jail for a very, very long time.
What happened to your health while you were in Nepal?
Well, yes. So I went with a group of friends. We went to what was then Burma. And we went up to Mandalay and Pagan and it was a great trip. But we all caught dysentery badly. So we ended up going to Calcutta very, very sick. And I was left behind because I was sick for quite a while and lost a lot of weight. And then I got the train and then the bus up to Kathmandu. And I was carrying speed, Dex, I think they called it in those days. I was always had drugs on me. And we got caught in this landslide, had to stay overnight in the bus. The local came in with some chai in those little clay pots. I'm thinking to myself, I really shouldn't drink this. I really shouldn't drink this. But I was so thirsty, I drank it. And the next morning, blood in my stools. I knew I had diarrhea again. So I dropped a few of the Dex speed to walk the 10 or 14 miles back to Kathmandu. And then I was stuck in Kathmandu for another 2 weeks, really sick, getting thinner all the time. And then I decided to do the Jamison track, like in plimsolls, like really, Kate. It was about a day's walk with some Gurkhas who were fabulous. They guided us. And I felt really sick and I stayed up there. Annapurna, I can still see Annapurna right in front of me. I stayed up there for a couple of days, lice in the bed. It was horrible. And I came back down because I knew I just was getting weak. Peed into a can and, yes, my urine was black and I knew that that meant I had hepatitis.
What kind of healthcare could you get there,
though? None. There was an American hospital there, so I took a sample of my urine there. They tested it and she said, Kate, you have to get out of here or you're going to die. You will not survive the winter here. You have to leave.
So where did you go?
Well, then I had to make a decision. Do I come back to Australia? But there was no health insurance here. There was just private health insurance.
Oh, this is pre-Medicare, isn't
it? Yeah, totally pre-Medicare. Yeah. Or I could go back to England. I needed help to get back down to Delhi to get a flight. And I was so thin, so weak, but I was very contagious and no one would come near me. I remember getting on one of the trains to Lucknow. And, I mean, I was yellow, I was thin as anything, and three tiers in the carriage, in the trains in India, third class. And they saw me and I've never forgotten this. The whole family came off. They came off the top and they let me lie down at the top. I've never forgotten the goodness of those people. And this one German traveller, he looked after me and he carried my pack because I was just so thin. Got to Delhi. I still had dope with me. I can't believe, you know, that's how stupid I was. I just kept carrying drugs with me, which soothed a bit of the pain. And I managed to get on a plane to London. I managed to get through, but then by the time I got to Manchester, I just got a cab to the Infectious Diseases Hospital, gave them the note from the doctor in Nepal, and they immediately took me into isolation. By then, I'm about 6 stone ringing wet, and it took a year to recover. So they said, you can't drink alcohol for 12 months. And I heard that. What I didn't hear them say was, but you can't take drugs.
Don't take heroin. Don't take this.
Yeah,
don't take that.
They didn't say that. They just said, you can't take alcohol. So I thought, fine. But that year that I was staying at home, I was straight. I was so sick. I couldn't do anything. My parents didn't want me there. They never really wanted me there. But I had nowhere else to go. So I slowly recovered enough to look for work. But I was straight in that time. I wasn't drinking or smoking cigarettes, but that's it. And then I started looking for work, and I found this job with this they were called NACRO, which was looking after young kids out of jail or with drug and alcohol problems, like a residential care network.
Like an NGO or something?
Exactly. Government funded. I mean, I was a compassionate person if I'd thought about it, but I just could see that I wanted to help people, even though I was hopelessly not looking after myself.
You needed help yourself.
So, you know, I told them about my travels and I don't know, I just had an interview and they gave me this job as a residential care worker looking after all these kids. But what I was to find was Patrick, my team leader, and it was actually a drug, like it was, he was using it to distribute drugs, and I became his, one of his drug dealers. And out came the cocaine, out came the heroin, out came...
This is your boss?
This is my boss.
Distributing drugs to who? Not to the
residents.
Right.
But to Manchester. So I would get very, very good quality dope from him, and I'd be selling it and he'd be providing me, and I'd make some and he'd make some. So the whole thing was a front. No one knew. Not till it all fell apart.
You would have been dealing with some very serious criminals at that point.
Yes, I was. I mean, I'm this naive. What am I now, like 23 or 24? I was so naive. He said, oh, we've got to go down to Bristol now. And we went to this place and literally there were like dark suits, sunglasses and guns. And they didn't smile. And I'm sitting there watching them do all this big-time drug dealing and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? That's where drugs can take you. They can take you into very, very dark places and you don't even realise at the time.
At one level, your life in your 20s is full of adventure, but it's a kind of reckless adventure. Do you think that's got something to do with the abuse you were talking about earlier that you suffered at the hands of that vile gardener all those years
Look,
ago?
I can only do that in retrospect, but when I look back at my life now, I can see that had that not happened to me, my life may have been different. I can't, of course, I don't know. But the effects of that... the self-destruction, the self-hatred. And so everything that I was doing was acting out of that space and I couldn't see it at the time. All that was a way of not dealing with what had happened. But what had happened was so repressed for all those years till it came up again, I didn't even think about it. I was just acting out, lots of sex with so many men.
And now a very serious criminal enterprise.
And now, getting into trouble with the police.
And how did you get out of that?
Well, I grasped on this person. What happened was I was off my face and I'd gone to work and the boss of the organisation saw that I was off my face and he sacked me.
This wasn't the drug dealing boss?
No.
This is the boss,
is it? The big boss above him. And then the next day I went back to work. He said, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm working here. He said, I sacked you yesterday. I couldn't remember. I just could not. I still do not remember being sacked. So I got sacked twice. That was it. I was out of a job. And I knew the police were starting to circle. And so I got rid of all my drugs. I still had the dope, though. You know, stupid, but I still had that in my house, in my little bedsit. And the speed that I was on, I'd become very, very paranoid. And I was starting to get scared because they kept mentioning my family. And I got really, really scared. And I felt, whether it was paranoia or not, someone was following me. And I just thought, I've got to get out of here or else I'm going to get done. And so I went to the police and I squealed on this guy. And I said, you don't touch him till I get out of the country. And they didn't touch him till I got out of that country. So that last month that I was in England, my sister lent me the money to get here.
Back to Australia.
Yeah, back to Australia. I was so paranoid. And then I was to learn, actually, he did get caught because I went back to try and make amends of sorts to some of the people that I had treated so badly, you know, just with my behaviour. And that organisation was still going. And that's when I learnt he'd hung himself in jail. So I, you know, I can't regret it, but that's the kind of insane world that so many people get caught up in. And that could have been me. He was offering me heroin like in a needle now. And I knew that if I didn't leave, if I stay here, that's what's going to happen to me. I had to get out.
Now, in the corny Hollywood movie of your life, Kate, this is the moment when you go, you wise up, you come back to sunny Australia, you clean up your act, and you go down the straight and narrow for a while. That's not what happened, though, is it?
No. Well, no. There's nothing straight and narrow about me. No. So, yes, I decided I'd had enough I was still smoking dope, though, but I landed, I got in with a household in Glebe near Wentworth Park. There was dope, but there was more alcohol, and I knew that I couldn't do the hard drugs anymore. But I was starting to fall to pieces, like I just, something was going on. So I started drinking a lot. Beer, which I hate. I mean, I just, anything that they put in front of me, anything to stop. And so what happened was that I actually went into a psychosis and I was mad. I literally went mad. And I saw a psychiatrist at Roselle and told him a whole lot of crap. But he gave me something called Modicate, which is a drug for schizophrenia. And that completely bombed me out. I tried to get myself into Roselle Hospital because I knew I just was falling apart. I was suicidal. I didn't know what was going on. Didn't know I was in a psychosis. And someone put me into a detox centre, and the person who answered the phone told me about this self-help group, and these people came and took me to this support group for people who are trying to get off drugs and alcohol. And that was the beginning. Well, now it's 48 years later. So, you know, that was when I first faced my demons, when I found ways and support groups to be able to face those demons without trying to hide anymore, because that's what had happened.
What did you come to realise about yourself once you truly got clean and sober?
That I was a mess, that I didn't know who I was, that I was a negative person, that I was full of shame and guilt, no self-confidence. And I didn't know, at 25, I didn't know how I was going to survive in the world. I came to see that there was nothing there. And someone sent me to, or suggested I go to see this beautiful alcohol counsellor. So I was about 8 months at this time. I tried to commit suicide 3 times that year, almost successful the last time. And she just said to me, Katie, you know, you're just a fragmented person. And when she used that word fragmented, there was like an actual gut reaction. That's how I felt I had been, not even thinking about the abuse, but certainly since the abuse. There was no joining of the dots. I was just a bit of this and a bit of that, which is why I could see I would travel, I'll go and do this, because I had no sense of who I was, what I wanted to do. It was always what other people wanted to do, well, I'll do that.
And what do you do about that, once you know that?
Well, it was an epiphany because she said, well, you can start again, Kate. You can start again, like a blank notebook. You can start your life again if you just grip the support stuff with both hands. And that's what I did. And I haven't picked up a drink or a drug all that time. Many, many things have happened in that time, some awful. But I've came to believe, for me, that I picking up anything, that means I've got the problem back again, worse probably. So it was all about learning to deal with life on life's terms without any substances.
There's a missing piece of the puzzle, though, that finally helped you connect all those fragmented bits of you, wasn't there?
Yes, yeah. In my first year of not having any drugs and alcohol, the first thing that came into me that I thought, oh, my God, I'm a lesbian. How crap is that? Like, just another reason to beat myself. Oh, my God, I'm a lesbian. I'm one of those. Oh, I hate myself. Everybody else hates gay people. And I just couldn't accept it. I wouldn't accept that that's what I was. Despite the fact that I started mixing with other lesbians, especially in the feminist, women's liberation, then I started getting involved in politics and all of that, and sleeping with lots of other women and realising, yes, this is me, but the other side of me still hated myself because society said you're shit. You're not straight, so you're not normal. That's the word. You're not normal.
We're talking about like the late 70s now?
Late 70s, yeah. 77, 78.
And how different were things? For people who don't remember,
Well, very different because I had actually, by this time, I had a job at the Maritime Services Board, which is now the Museum of Contemporary Art, had the best view ever. I was just a shit kicker there. But back then, the whole culture was the gay male culture, which is still something else. But within the lesbian community, it was you were either a dyke, butch dyke, or you were a femme. Like, there was nothing in between. And I've always and still really identify as being quite androgynous, not just in dress. I'm just me, and I just don't feel like I'm femme or butch. I'm just androgynous. I call myself androgynous. And so I got introduced by these other lesbians to Ruby's, which no longer exists, was, I think, the only lesbian bar, plenty of gay male bars, but this was the only lesbian one. Lots of envelopes being passed, say no more, run by a certain person who got the money. And I went up there, and I just remember the first time I went up there, I was in awe of all these lesbians, but all dressed either butch or dyke. And I love dance. I'm a hopeless dancer, but I love to watch people dance. And I'm watching this amazing dancing, and the next thing I know, this butch dyke has got hold of my collar, smashed my head against the wall, and said, "If you look at my girl once more, I'll smash your brains out." And she threw me down the stairs. She threw me down.
God.
And, you know, and I just thought, you can imagine what I thought. And I don't think I went there for a while after that. Oh. But it was a very, very narrow, closed community, and of course, massive amounts of drinking.
So you're not really getting much community in Ruby's nightclub then?
No.
But
no.
June 1978.
Yeah.
You were there for the very first Sydney Mardi Gras, that famous Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
What was the atmosphere like when you all assembled for the start of that?
So that was the beginning of my political awakening, if you like. I'd started going to Women's Liberation, and I'd gone, there was a, had been a homosexual, that was the word then. There weren't many people. I think all up there were about 1,000. I mean, when you look at it now, there were about 1,000 people. One truck and Tom Robinson singing Glad to Be Gay and Meg Christian singing Ode to a Gin Teacher. The atmosphere of being able to walk down the street, it was nighttime, so you couldn't, but people would gape with their eyes open. And I just felt like I'd become part of a community. I found my tribe and I was happy. Suddenly thought, oh, it's okay to be a lesbian. It's okay. Scream and shout. So I was hoarse by the time I got to King's Cross. I just screamed out, up the lesos. All the time, because I just suddenly felt, I'm a lesbian, yay, like this is cool.
Up the lesos.
Yeah, up the lesos. And then people don't realise that when we ended up at El Alamein Fountain, basically it had fizzled out. We just stood, oh, well, it's all over. I know it was midnight or something.
So it had gone from Oxford Street in Darlinghurst up to King's Cross, the El Alamein Fountain
there. That's right, yeah.
And what happened once this party started seemingly to fizzle out at that point?
As we were walking up William Street, which we did then didn't have a permit for, we only had the permit to what's now Whitlam Square, but we just thought, F it, we're just going to keep going because the energy was amazing. So we could see these trucks going across past the cola sign, or you'd look up down a side street and say, oh, there's lots of trucks. Didn't really take any notice, just saw them. And then when we got to Alamein Fountain, it was all over, like everybody go home. So, oh, okay. So we just started to disperse, really, and start going home. And that's when the noise happened. And that's when the big, really big, fat, drunk cops, suddenly they were everywhere. They'd actually, like a pincer movement, had surrounded us so we couldn't go anywhere. Every street was blocked. And the only way out was Darlinghurst Road, and there they were just waiting to pick us off. And so people were getting pulled out everywhere, push me, pull you. Someone threw a really heavy litter bin lid into my back. It really hurt. I don't know who threw it. I got grounded. Then I got pulled. And I had a friend trying to pull me this way. My glasses were pulled off. I pulled this way and that way. But the cops, they were really big men, like rugby players, overweight rugby players.
And drunk, you say?
Yeah, you could smell the alcohol. No names, nothing. I got thrown into a paddy wagon, and then there was another person, and then we got taken down to Darlinghurst Police Station and all the women in one jail. I think there were 23 of us, and then there were about 24 men in another one, but we could hear each other.
Some of those police would have been the same police who had been extorting protection money from gay nightclubs and bars.
I'm not surprised. I would imagine so, because it was Darlinghurst. Darlinghurst back then, it was very, very corrupt. Those bars only remained open because a certain person was making sure that they paid protection money, and that's so there were lots of envelopes. That's all I'm saying.
So were you dragged in and charged?
Yes. We all got queued up, and so we'd start, and we could hit. The other thing was there were massive crowd people outside. They all started fundraising to give us bail money, and you could hear them, and that was wonderful, because I can tell you we were scared in that cell. We had no idea what was going to happen.
What were you charged with?
Up the lesos. Unseemly words. I said, well, what are you going to charge me with? Unseemly words, up the lezzos. That was on my charge sheet. They just made up charges. Others got made up charges.
And when they said that to you, what, were you too frightened to laugh? Or
no,
you...
I laughed. I just laughed because I was surrounded by everybody. I wasn't on my own. I was, you know, there were 50 of us in there. The week ended up being sent down to Central before we got discharged. And there were people outside. So it was the community. You felt I was being protected to some regard. So I felt like I could make light of it. And then we were released, and then I was on my own at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was horrible. It was like I was all on my own, and lots of people, our names were in the paper. They knew I was part of it when I went to work, and that's when it got really nasty. I had pornographic material put in my office drawers. I had lemons placed everywhere. People walked on the other side of the corridors. No one would talk to me. I went into a really bad depression. We had lots of meetings and organisation and more demonstrations. I just ran to those because if it wasn't for those, I probably would have gone back into the closet. I just was so depressed at the way that, oh, I'm still not normal. I'm hated for what I am. And I have to say the only way my job was saved was Michael. He was my HR manager. He was an American. And he was gay. He was a closet gay. And he told me, he called me up and he said, you've got to keep your head down. The only reason you've got this job is because I've saved it. And I'll be ever thankful for that man. I would have lost my job like I think others did on that night. So it was very nasty for a very long time.
So now we move forward to 1987, and this is one of the darkest episodes in your book. You had fallen in love with a woman, living in different houses though, and then one night you write that your home was invaded and you were sexually assaulted by a man with a knife. This is utterly traumatic and terrifying. Afterwards, you write, you called a rape crisis centre.
Yes. I called a friend of mine who lived in Maroubra. She was there within 40 minutes. Because I was naked. I was completely in shock. I didn't know what to do. She came, she called rape crisis, and she put the phone on. She said, my name's Anne. She was the counsellor. She was the worker at Rape Crisis at the time. I said, my name's Kate Rowe. She said, you're Kate Rowe. And she knew me. She was a friend of mine. So they came round with the dog, and then they sorted it out, took me to hospital.
Why with the dog?
Oh, because the person was still there. But he'd fled. The place was a mess. And there was a backyard, which is where we think he came in. And it was more protection for not only for me, but for them as well. But they took me to the hospital and I got the best counsellor in the world. And she told me I had 48 hours to report it to the police. And in retrospect, had I not been in trauma, I would have actually done it straight away because there would have been more chance of catching him. But I waited that 48 hours and then I said to the counsellor, okay, I want to go to the police, which was on the Monday. This happened in the early hours of Saturday morning.
Were they still able to collect compelling evidence?
They did. They got evidence. They got footprints, semen. They had a semen sample, my clothes, blood. I was bleeding at the time, so there was blood on the sheets, but it wasn't. But also I got cut, but it was more the semen sample that was important, which they lost.
They
lost it. So they had a lot of evidence, but he was wearing a mask. I've since had cataract surgery, but I had appalling eyesight, no glasses on. He had a mask on, so I could never identify him, but I did remember his voice. And that made it more difficult.
Had there been similar incidents in the area from this same man?
From what he was saying to me as he was doing all of this, which is why I figured out he'd done this, because he said, I've done this before. I hate my mother. He said that. And I hate my mother and I hate women. And then it started again. And
this is pure misogyny,
yeah,
is it?
Like pure misogyny. Yeah. And it was a pattern. It's the same thing over and over again. They just repeat their own little game, whatever that game is, acting it out. But when I went to the police that following Monday, they put a rookie cop, female cop, to interview me and take my statement. And she was so shocked. She was shaking. She was white as a sheet. And subsequently, when I tried to start it as a cold case, I got this other detective came to interview me. She looked at the statement and she said, there's so many holes in this. This is the most appalling statement.
Oh, she was too upset to draft it properly, was
Yeah,
she
was too upset. And then I tried two or three times to get the evidence to start it as a cold case. And this fabulous detective who was working on a serial killer cold case, it was actually in the same time frame. So she took it seriously and asked. It was the most incredibly intense, proper interview. Had I been interviewed by that, things might have been different. And she tried to find the evidence, but they didn't keep the evidence. That was the problem. And so I've had to accept that's the end of the line for me.
This man's never been identified.
No. He may be still out there doing it. He's probably, well, I mean, who knows? I mean, I was 37 at the time. I felt like he was a bit older. He had a deeper voice. But, yeah, so those things in the next 8 years of not being able to pick up a drink or a drug, not to take anything, no medication. I decided I didn't want any medication, even though it was offered to me, meant that I had to face that stone cold sober. So it was 8 years of madness, really.
And what about trust issues, particularly around men?
Yeah. The anger I had over men was for a long time, a very, very long time. What I learned from that, though, which is, I just think it's magic, is I actually have learned, because all my boundaries, I mean, I had no boundaries from the childhood abuse. That was one of my problems. I couldn't respect other people's boundaries when I was in relationships because I didn't have any. They'd been taken away from me. So I would just walk over people's boundaries all the time. A really bad habit of mine, not now. But one of the things in my healing journey was I learned to have I got a boundary for the first time. So now I actually have more male friends. I am not scared of men. I'm hypervigilant, unfortunately, all the time, so I don't sleep well. I perk my hearing. I'm on hyper alert all the time. I've learned to live with it. But I've learned that I can, that if I feel like a man is threatening me, sometimes it triggers my trauma, but sometimes I can just walk away or say expletives, like I get angry. So I'm not perfect. But I have learned that I've learned how to look after myself.
How do you spend your days now, Kate, now that you're in your 70s?
Well, you know, after all of that, in my 50s, because I was always a runner before this even happened, I took up sport when I stopped smoking. And I've been an athlete ever since I was a kid, really. But that was another thing that took me off that track, all the abuse that stopped. So I took up long-distance triathlon, Ironmans, done 10 of those. I was doing athletics at international level for my age group. And after 20 years of that, when I was 69, I went on a world travel trip and I went to Antarctica in 2019, just before COVID. And I had such a, dare I say, a spiritual experience. Antarctica just blew my head away.
What do you mean by spiritual experience?
Well, I just felt this strong presence of, oh, I understand, not that I do because of the title of the book, but I just felt a part of, in the most intense, magical way, seeing waves literally on top of a dead volcano, looking down at the ship, this pristine water, icebergs, penguins, and then these three whales just like 300 metres away started breaching. And I just was in tears. I just thought, oh, my God, This was magic. This is being alive. I understand why I'm just a dot. I'm a dot in a dot. I'm a dot in space.
That was a comfort, was it?
Absolutely. It was just this strength I got from just those few minutes of being on the top, those particular minutes in 12 days in Antarctica. But the whole trip was just mind-blowing. And I came back and I got Guardia, unfortunately, but I got it.
Sorry, that's not funny, but.
Yeah. I think I got it in Cuba.
You got an epiphany and Guardia.
Yeah. So again, I was quite sick when I got back, but it was a time when I thought, I need to change. I'm not scared of change. And I can't get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and do a 100K ride and another 20K ride. I can't do it anymore. I need to find something else. And so I took up the ukulele just before COVID hit. So that was 6 years ago. And I'm still playing it. I've got a wonderful teacher who's also a fabulous friend of mine, just accepts me for who I am. And am I a great player? I'm a competent. I mean, I play and I practice every day because I'm a disciplined person. And it just brings so much joy to my life. And there's a whole planet of older, grey-haired, mainly women but men, who are all out there just having fun playing this, what people think is a silly instrument. Oh, my God, there's some really virtuosos, I can tell you, not me. And I've just come to a place at 74 where I feel absolutely content. I'm happy with myself. Things happen, but I find I don't live in the problem. I look for solutions. And that's to be at this, I feel it's a blessing.
As you've been talking, Kate, I mean, there's a lot of conversation that goes on at the moment about how bad things are and how much worse they're getting in the world. I'm reminded, hearing your story, of how much better things are in a whole lot of respects. Is that your view?
I'm grateful. When I look at the world, and the last 2 years have been particularly awful for globally, I just think we're in a really dystopian place, and I fear about the possibility of a third world war. But in all of that, I just wake up in the morning. I've woken up, number one, I'm alive, and I get through the day and I put my head on the pillow and say, thank you, I'm alive. Life is precious and I'm not going to waste it. And I just look for the little things in life that help me feel better and that I try and help other people.
Whales and ukuleles.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That would have been a much less interesting title for your memoir.
Yeah, totally.
Amazing story, Kate. Thank you very much for sharing it.
Thank you.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more Conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Today's conversation with Kate Rowe was made in the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer is Maggie Morris. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.